This is the opportunity just to relax into about half an hour. You might all get bored witless. I know it's a graveyard slot after lunch. You might be all bored witless and go to sleep. And you have permission to go to sleep. If you want to go to sleep, that's fine. I'll carry on, you know. And it's something that Sue, for example, Philippa, Paul Curie, I mean, there are some of us who are absolutely passionate about teacher learning. And I take Helen Timperley's, and I'm sure it's probably been used before, imprecation about teacher learning in her best educational practice review for New Zealand. She said, for policymakers, these findings of the BES program, which many of you will be very familiar with, for policymakers, the findings of the BES program confirm the importance of professional development as possibly one of the highest impact policy levers in education, with potentially transformational effects on both social and academic outcomes from the education system. I mean, that really is a strong statement, and it's something that I fundamentally believe in. There, in this country, and I'm afraid globally, there's all sorts of debates about structures, but actually, it's teacher policy, damn it, or stupid, that actually, for me, is really where it's at, and I want to explore that. Helen Timperley's absolutely right analysis. So I thought I would start with a bit of history. Some of you are very familiar with it. And I won't go on too much about history because it can be very boring and irrelevant, but I did think one of the most important papers that the previous government actually produced in 1998, Teachers Meeting the Challenge of Change. Does anyone remember Teachers Meeting the Challenge of Change? I thought some of you do. Was completely obscured by the furore over performance-related pay, and there were sections in it that were completely ignored and shouldn't have been. I remember Michael Barber writing it, and he said he put himself into Purdue, and he crashed his way through a whole set of things, one of them being that the collective culture of the teaching profession was something that was really problematic. I'm not sure he would say that now at all, actually. But he was very anti it then. But there is a section in there which some of you will remember, and that is a new training framework. He talked about a new training framework for teachers, and that there were three distinct and equally important elements to be taken into account. National training priorities focused on particular needs which had been identified, e.g. literacy, numeracy, ICT, headship training and special educational needs, and then school priorities emerging from school development planning and Ofsted action plans, and then individual development needs of teachers identified through annual appraisal. And what he'd done, it seemed to me, was go back to the James Report of 1971 and then pulled that out and put it into the, I think it was a green paper, it wasn't a white paper, it was a green paper. And that seemed to be about the right structure. James was right in 1971, he put that forward, and as I say, it was completely obscured by all the big debate about performance-related pay and the threshold and all the rest of it. But to Estelle Morris and David Blunkett's credit, they actually did work up a short-lived professional development strategy, which, so far as I'm concerned, in terms of its iteration and the way in which it was constructed, is about as good as it gets and is an exemplar, really, for any future reforming government which has woken up and smelt the coffee about the fact that you need an education system, a systemic approach to teacher learning and a systemic approach to teacher professional development. I'll come back to whether or not the current Secretary of State does have that approach or not in a bit. But what I did think was important about it was that how, even though the very short-lived professional development strategy was launched in 2001 by Estelle Morris, was only short-lived, it was very powerful at the time. But when I did some interviews with John Macbeth and Maurice Galton for our book Reinventing Schools, Reforming Teaching, was a history of the Blair education reforms, it really struck me how vulnerable teacher learning and teacher professional development was to political turbulence, And what a low priority teacher learning and teaching professional development is. It is the default position for cuts is always teacher learning and teacher professional development. And that's the case now, and it was the case then. But there were some curious side effects. I don't know if anyone remembers a lovely person actually called Richard Harrison. Obviously Philippa and Paul and colleagues will, but he was the department official put in charge of putting together the teacher professional development strategy prior to 2001. And he was a lovely guy, actually, and he took he did it in the most honourable way. He did what department officials do in the old days, and that is go out and listen and not take any pejorative views about the comments being made. But he tried to put together a genuine consensus of partners to actually make a professional development strategy work, and above all, owned by the teaching profession. And he said, when I first began, I had no perception of where teachers were in their development because I had not worked in schools at all. I was coming to it completely fresh. I tried to use that as a strength. I would say, I know nothing about this area. Tell me about it. Tell me what's happening. I was a bit like a sponge in picking up views, and I tried to select people to talk to who then told me what would be informative and knowledgeable and balance themselves. So through these conversations, I developed a view that was reflected in the strategy. And what was reflected in the strategy was that number of things, actually. First, he wanted to have evidence of what worked in professional development, which at the time was, and there was a really big exception or an exception that came over the hill, was very tough. I remember the NFER doing a survey on what worked in teacher learning, and they couldn't find too much. I did a lovely interview with Gillian Shepherd and Pauline Perry. Thank you very much, Mary. You would know Pauline very well, so I appreciate what she's done. But both she and Shirley Williams actually did have a huge amount of professional development money in the back end of the 70s Labour government, and local authorities spent it on everything else bar professional development. And apparently they were in tears over it when they had a look at the results of it. So it just shows how vulnerable it is. But Gillian Shepherd was very, very strong about it, actually. And she said this lovely quote from her saying that you can say what you like as a minister, but when you are as a teacher inside the classroom, you're on your own. And my job is to support teachers. Now, you know, I just wish the current Secretary of State would remember that. Actually, Richard Harrison did remember that, and he wanted evidence of teacher learning and teacher professional development. And he also wanted buy-in from the professional associations, including teacher unions. And therefore, we were in a situation when the money came out for 2001, that is my old union where I was head of education, the NUT, of actually making collective bids for the work for the particular projects that were available. So if we just segue away from that a little bit. The Green Paper created a lot of debate, a huge amount of debate, actually, about not only performance pay, but also about the nature of professional learning. And this is where Cure comes in. And I'm absolutely in favour of serendipity and synchronicity and all the rest of it, and also chaos theory. My old union wouldn't have spent upwards of £70,000, which is big money in those days, actually, on a research review with Cure on what worked in professional development. My union wouldn't have spent that money. I don't think the orientation of the teacher professional development strategy would have been the way it was in terms of best practice research scholarships and all the rest of it if my union hadn't actually commissioned Cure to do that work. All that hinged on the fact that I just happened to pop into the Institute one afternoon and Philippa came over to me and said and hissed at me, did I know that the NESUWT were doing a research, a teacher professional development program? So I came back and for once my old General Secretary was in the pub on a Friday afternoon. I mean, never, he was never in on a Friday normally, but for some curious reason he was in the Dolphin, which we used to call Committee Room D, on that afternoon. And I explained what Philippa had told me. He said, well, we'll have a professional development program then. And he committed about 2% there and then of the whole union budget to actually doing it. I couldn't believe it. And we had carte blanche. We had £70,000 to spend on the research review. The work that QRA did for us was extraordinary. We did it with one of the best information people, i.e. Janet Friedlander, and over 16,000 articles were reviewed with a series of keywords. And what popped out at the other end was that collaborative professional development. And collaborative professional development, which involved expert input, practice, and then evaluation of practice at the end of it, was by far and away the best possible professional development and had big effects, notably on the Holy Grail, i.e. student outcomes, although quite tough for teachers sometimes, actually. And we used that for the creation of our professional development program, but more importantly, perhaps for the long term, for the policy implications, the government absorbed that at the time. And Richard Harrison was enormously influenced in the creation of the professional development strategy. We had best practice research scholarships, and he was very sympathetic to the idea of BPRS being a collaborative approach with teachers working in pairs, videoing each other in the classroom, etc., etc. Very, very much open to that. And interestingly, the policy echo of that carried on into the coalition, with the white paper that the coalition produced on teacher policy, actually including a great section on the research review that QRA had done on the best forms of professional development. I'm not sure they mentioned the NUT. I think it's sort of, you know, the word NUT kind of turns into dust in the department's mouth, but it's certainly QRA was mentioned on that basis. So it had an enormous echo, and it just confirmed every bit of my belief about chaos theory. Now, we constructed in the NUT a program which I think at the time, and as a colleague from the NUT still here, and Taj will remember all this, actually produced great buy-in from teachers themselves, teachers who actually attended the courses. And it was constructed around the principles, largely, of the QRA research review, of the EPI review. And the principles were that teachers learn collectively in collaborative situations much better together, that actually tutoring and mentoring is very, very important, and peer coaching is very, very important in a non-threatening environment, that teachers being able to be analytical about each other's practice in the context of learning was very, very important. Expert input was very, very important, but experts had to get their hands dirty and actually be prepared to have their own views challenged by the outcomes of professional development of whatever particular approach was being carried out in the classroom. But actually, I think it's fair to say that at its height, our teacher-to-teacher and teachers-together programs had no lower than 90% high satisfaction rate from anyone who attended those programs. Everyone. In fact, actually, we discovered when we looked at the... I just want to pay tribute, by the way, not only to Taj, but to my very old friend and colleague, Richard Stainton, who ran the program, actually against enormous physical challenge. He'd lost both his kidneys, and he was working from home and all the rest of it, but he did a fantastic job. But what we found from that program was that as a retention thing, it was fantastic, particularly for mature teachers who had come to the point when, ennui sets in, not only ennui, but just stress, and found that the kind of dialogue and iteration that happened through teacher learning of a collaborative basis was actually a great retention thing, and that it had actually revived teachers' enthusiasm for their profession, for their learning, for their subject, for their discipline, in a way that they hadn't found anywhere else. So that actually there was this fantastic knock-on in terms of collaborative professional development. As I say, the department gave us a lot of money through the best practice research scholarships, and I think we got some money for early professional development as well at the time. But come 2003, there was a small, tiny crisis in funding, and Judy Seber, who was in charge of the research department at the department at the time, or the research unit at the time, was so angry about the way in which the crisis was handled. And I have to say, it was not ACSL's finest hour. And I've said this to John Dunford, that his agreement with government that to actually to make up the shortfall in funding in school budgets, axing the professional development strategy was one of the worst decisions he'd ever made. But it did demonstrate Richard Harrison's anxiety and worry about the fact that actually, although he'd been given fantastic leeway, and actually incidentally attributed the fact that his professional leeway of listening to teachers was the fact was due to the fact it was a very low policy priority. That was the point. If it had been a high policy priority, teachers wouldn't have been listened to in any way, shape or form. But so you had a trade-off between a fantastic consensus on teacher learning, a low policy priority, and then, of course, the first little squall that came up in terms it got blown out of the water with the connivance of one of the head teacher professional associations. And Judy actually went public over it and got her knuckles wrapped massively because she said that in the Times Educational Supplement at the time. And it was a tragedy, as far as I'm concerned, because it could have embedded a model for the new government coming in, which could have, I think, influenced the current government's approach to training schools. So, I just want to reflect on that a little bit. I'll come back, I think, to Michael Gove and do we run an education system? And I'll sort of segue a little bit. How long have I got? Got a bit more on. Right, okay, I'll segue a little bit. Oh, I just want to do a... I thought Philippa and Cure's Source for the Goose, by the way, which says that teacher learning is very, very similar to student learning, but there is a little question of age and what you do it for and all the rest of it, and let's have a discipline. For teacher learning, and a particular approach to it was very, very important and very good. I'm now going to move, I think, to the issue of where we are internationally. Now, the reason why I'm doing it, it seems a bit clunky, is that I am peculiarly sensitized towards international developments, because I now work as Senior Consultant Education International, which is the organization that speaks for all the teacher organisations in the world. And my job is to relate to the OECD and liaise with the OECD, and I'm chair of the Trade Union Advisory Committee on Education at the OECD. It's been a peculiarly fortuitous time for me to be there and do that, actually, because I'm going to say something that may be a bit shocking. Our current Secretary of State is the most internationally minded Secretary of State I've ever come across. No other Secretary of State is like him. That's his advantage. His disadvantage is that his, in my view, his own predilections are so strong, and his own the way in which he approaches life is so strong, that he is able to delude himself that the bits of the cherry that he picks out of any international evidence is actually part of a coherent whole, even though it isn't in any way, shape, or form. But it does mean that his clear confidence in the way in which he cherry-picks international evidence means that it disarms opponents completely, actually. I mean, I don't know where the Labour Party is at the moment in terms of... I mean, I think we're on the first rung. I think Stephen Twigg's speech actually just started to recognise that there was an issue there that you had to take into account. Developments in other countries across the world, particularly developed countries in the OECD. And I think they've just begun to realise it. But I think every time he sort of prayed in aid, Andrew Schleicher, it's meant that the Labour Party and other parties are actually on the back foot all the time because they don't know what he's talking about. He does. He knows what he's talking about completely. He's got a very dynamic international evidence section at the department as well. That put that to one side, I think that in the last decade, and Sue will be familiar with this actually, the OECD's Education Directorate have been on a roll. And it's not only the Programme for International Student Assessment, which I can talk about till the cows come home, but also the Teaching and Learning International Study, which came out in 2008, and the next one is coming out in 2013. And there is another aspect that, apart from the research, which is very, very important indeed, and that is the agreement by Arnie Duncan, the Education Secretary of the United States, to actually host in 2011 the summit for the international teaching the international summit for the teaching profession. Now, some of you may have heard about it. For as far as I'm concerned, I might as well have died and gone to heaven when I actually attend the first summit, because it's constructed on the on this basis that up to two teacher organisation leaders per country and one minister, and they have to be there, all three, those teacher organisation leaders, one or two, and the minister, they sit down and they make policy and they discuss policy for teacher policy, for the future of the teaching profession itself. And Duncan wanted to do this because I think clearly what was happening was they were worried about Obama's second term and they wanted to get the NEA and the AFT on board, the two biggest teacher unions in the world. But that's a cynical view. I actually genuinely think that their international department in the US is great. I think it's a really, really good, high-quality department. I think they also genuinely wanted, and you, if you notice something about US educational research, it's completely introverted. Actually, a lot of it is. But he wanted to shift the debate, Duncan wanted to shift the debate towards an international discourse about what worked in other countries. So for all those reasons, they put together the International Summit. And the invitations were on the basis of countries which were rapidly improving, according to the Programme for International Student Assessment, or were in the first 25. Now, it's interesting to note that actually the UK was 25 on the list. The US wouldn't have made it if they weren't hosting it. And Sweden didn't make it the first time, interestingly, on the basis of the 2009 results. But there was so much furore about it that they actually drew the line a little bit below to allow Sweden in, and they had to let Hungary in as well. But that said, the construction was fantastic, and I don't think I have been to a better, a more mature discussion between ministers and trade union leaders and teacher organisation leaders than I have at those summits. And I just want to actually pick out some of the very, very important things. It triggered Andreas Schleicher in particular into doing a review of all the teacher policy that he could extract from PISA and the Teaching and Learning International Study. And one of the things we were astounded at, actually, were a number of things we were astounded at in the original background document they produced for the first summit, Building a High-Quality Teaching Profession, was this statement where he said, "Successful reform cannot wait for a new generation of teachers. It requires investment in the present teacher workforce, providing quality professional development, adequate career structures and diversification, and enlisting the commitment of teachers to reform." Now, he said, you can't wait. You can't rely on this magical idea that all you have to do is recruit the top 10% or the top 2% of graduates, etc., etc. You have to train your current workforce if you are to be an outstanding, to be considered to be an outstanding education system. Now that's very, very important, and it was a stunning little statement which we use mercilessly in all our stuff. So that was important. The second thing is, and I want to pay tribute to Ben Levin, was Ben Levin's blog that he produced in March, whenever it was. Let's have a look. March 2010, where he said, "Let's stop blaming teacher unions." Where he said, "I've done a bit of research, and all this stuff about how teacher unions can actually destroy country education systems or a blockage to reform is wrong. Virtually all the top performing countries on international education measures have strong teacher unions, including Finland, Korea, Japan, Canada, Australia, and others. This relationship doesn't imply causation, but it does suggest there is no necessary conflict between strong teacher unions and good outcomes." And then he throws down a challenge, which is why I want to come back to teacher learning and professional development, and it's a challenge to teachers and their organisations. The first challenge is the knowledge base for professional practice. How can we actually put together a knowledge base for professional practice? And when you put that knowledge base together, is it challenging to the status quo and also teacher unions? And the second challenge is supporting professional learnings. Many teachers are inveterate learners. And he says that actually teacher unions that took on these two challenges in a positive way could make an important contribution. And he, as I say, he takes the evidence from that that actually teacher unions in the most outstanding countries are actually already doing that. So the other thing I was going to actually refer to in terms of the international evidence was how strong some of the stuff was. Singapore, now there's a big debate. I realise there's a big debate about Singapore and about what's happening in Singapore, and they've got shed loads of money, etc., etc. But actually, I have to say that Singapore's approach towards integrating the evaluation process with putting together a strategy for teacher learning is something which did capture the imaginations, not just of country ministers, but also teacher unions as well, particularly the NEA and the AFT, particularly the line from Singapore when the minister said, "I want to remove salary as a consideration in making a career choice to be a teacher." That really endeared him to the union members, because actually the union leaders, i.e. you have to pay competitive salaries. But what he also said was that actually evaluation should be there to continually enhance and inform teacher learning needs, analysis of teacher learning needs, and actually contributing to their wider sense of being professionals. Now, whether that's the case or not, actually talking that particular talk in that circumstance was very, very important and actually did break up what was quite an arid logjam about performance-related pay. So I'll just come to another little bit about the OECD, and that is TALIS itself. The Teaching and Learning International study has had a major impact internationally, but its first report did not have an impact in this country, principally because the Labour government didn't want to take part. And Peter Mortimer once phoned me up and said, "Can you think of anything, John? I'm trying to actually be fair in this book I'm writing. Can you think of anything that you can praise the coalition for?" And I said, "Well, you could praise them for actually joining the Teaching and Learning International study," which they have done, believe it or not. What is so important about it is that its headings for its questionnaire, which is about teacher learning and professional development, leadership, etc., almost completely define under their headings, under the headings for the research questions, define what teacher policy is about. So if you have a look at the questionnaires for TALIS, if you want to know what teacher policy is and how do you define it and what are its shape and what are its components, that's what TALIS defines. And I have to say, I've got to give credit to the OECD. They fully incorporated teacher organisations in the construction of the questionnaires. And the IEA were very, very good as well. And we had some very, very tough discussions. But I have to say, I think the 2013 TALIS, which is going to be launched in June next year, is going to be very, very important for the construction of teacher policy. And I'm not even sure, bearing in mind that both the UK, France and the US are new members of TALIS, that actually this could be used to start shifting the government on having a coherent teacher policy. And the last bit of this, the last international bit I want to talk a little bit about, is teacher leadership. Now, in my year here, I did some research with David Frost, which was fascinating actually for Education International, on a policy framework for teacher organisations for teacher leadership, and explored the discussions about teacher leadership. And it strikes me that in a sense the words teacher leadership are a metaphor for something which the OECD constantly goes on about, and that is you cannot have an effective teacher policy without teachers having high levels of self-efficacy, and the word self-efficacy actually echoes through TALIS as well. And in a sense the words teacher leadership are exactly synonymous with the term teacher self-efficacy, which is why David and I called it teacher self-efficacy, voice and leadership towards a policy framework. And what we found, and David's been running the International Teacher Leadership Program, particularly in Eastern European countries, is that actually if you say to teachers, you can be leaders in your discipline, you can be leaders in your school, it is right and people should expect, you should be able to comment and have ideas about other people's primary disciplines as well, instead of everyone involved in their own little bunkers. It is right to have an outward-facing approach and not simply think about your school, etc., etc., that the term teacher leadership is very, very powerful in that sense. And I'll give you a quote, actually, because probably the country where teacher leadership has the greatest material policy clothes is the United States. And this is from a senior policy analysis, actually Linda Davin in the National Education Association. She says, teacher leadership is a concept whose time has come. For the NEA, teacher leadership is not a new concept. In fact, before formal teacher leadership roles existed in schools, it was the teachers' unions associations that provided opportunities for teachers to lead and influence policy and practice outside their classrooms. Teacher leadership occurs when teachers, formally or informally, take on roles that allow them to influence teaching and learning beyond their classroom. Absolutely, is all I can say. And that debate about how you actually raise teacher capacity through raising levels of teacher self-efficacy and having the professional confidence to come up with ideas and not simply leave it to the leadership team within the individual schools is a major debate. And for those who have come across Cambridge University's annual seminar on the future of the teaching profession, you may have come across Ron Thorpe, who is the chief executive of the National Board for Professional Teaching Standards, the NBTS. I can't remember to get the acronym right. But actually, Ron is fantastic. And I think he'd been to Cambridge just once last year or the year before last. And that is actually what that board does is actually provide an embryonic federal formation for superintendents in the United States, for teacher union leaders, and for teachers themselves to come together to debate the nature of teaching standards and professional development. And it's a very powerful organization, and it's spawned another very, very interesting organization called the Teacher Leadership Exploratory Consortium, which has put together teacher leadership standards. Now, David will kill me if I don't mention the fact that David and I have a big debate about whether or not you can actually put together in a formal way teacher leader professional standards or whether it's much more a state of mind. That debate is continuing and it's an entirely healthy one, but I have to mention that. Where are we? By the way, I was going to say, actually, the OECD have adopted teacher leadership as a major thing, and they mentioned Hallinger and Heck, and they're finding that collaborative leadership actually offers a path to school improvement, and mention also the work of David on the International Teacher Leadership Consortium as well, and they've given that a fair win, which is quite interesting, actually. So where are we to wrap it up? I think there have been, in England, some amazing developments in the recent past. And by the way, I was a supporter of the literacy and numeracy strategies, so you can all shout at me now if you want to. I was in favour of them. I think actually they were messed up by a top-down approach, but actually the construction of the strategies as they were rolled out meant that there were development of teacher experts locally who really did know about literacy and numeracy and had a relationship with schools, and that's gone. And now we're in a balkanized situation where schools simply don't have the mechanisms to talk to each other about leading edge developments in terms of literacy and numeracy. And I think at some point down the track, the government's going to see results falling when it comes to their own tests at key stage two. So I think there have been real developments. I think this government's... I did a speech at the ACSL conference and I said, Gove has to wake up and smell the coffee. The really boring debate and irrelevant debate is whether you devolve responsibility to individual schools or whether you keep it centrally. It is an utter waste of time, that debate. I can say that now. The real debate is actually, do you have a systemic approach to teacher policy in any country? That is the crucial debate. And what is interesting, and the next international summit for the teaching profession will be in New Zealand, is that New Zealand has probably the greatest devolved system in the world, where school boards and principals actually are responsible, but they also have a fantastically systemic approach towards professional development. And they have the structures nationally to actually keep that in place. What they don't have is a middle tier, and there's a genuine debate about a middle tier and local democracy, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, New Zealand is able to get by without a middle tier. And it has, for example, a qualifications authority, a New Zealand Teachers Council, a careers approach, a tertiary education commission, a whole range of stakeholder groups at national level, where the kind of debates that happen, for instance, about Maori education and how kids falling back from socially deprived areas can be tackled. That debate is stimulated by a government which actually understands it's running an education system. If there's one criticism I have of this government, is it doesn't know it's running an education system. It simply does not. And it's exemplified more than anything else by the fact that we don't have a proper teacher policy, and within that, a strategy for teacher learning and professional development. We do not have that. What we have is an imprecation that individual schools know better than anyone else about teacher learning, which actually raises the old Rumsfeldian quote about how you don't know what you don't know. We don't have a situation where, and that's what the strategy is provided in literacy and numeracy, knowledge from teachers can actually be used across the country, and that actually that provides the basis for a national approach and a national perception about what the teaching profession is about. And if I were the opposition, I would not start inventing new structures to say what the teachers need is a particular college or anything. Actually, what the government does need to understand, and this is Ben Levin's approach, the OECD approach is that you will never get your reforms in place on an embedded basis unless you bring teachers along with you, whether or not it's a teacher organisation. But you will never get it unless you bring the teaching profession along with you. That raises some interesting questions about this country, about what it should do. I attended, and I noticed Paul attended, the launch of the Royal College for Learning, which Charlotte Leslie is MP, is actually doing a lot of work, and I've got to pay tribute to her. She's done a really good job, actually. Gove says, I don't want anything to do with it. It'd be the kiss of death if I put my hands on it. Well, to a certain extent, he's right. It would be the kiss of death. But on the other hand, that abnegates the government's role entirely in terms of how it actually relates to the teaching profession and how there's a dialogue about how you actually raise teachers' self-efficacy. To actually, for a government to stand back from any debate about teacher self-efficacy, it seems to me lunacy. What should any government do? And I'll be completely neutral, whether or not it's a new government coming in 2015 and whatever political complexion. They should do exactly what the International Summit for the Teaching Profession has done, and that is sit down with teacher union leaders and representatives of teachers outside teacher unions and actually say, how do we construct and what are the priorities for the teaching profession drawing on international evidence? And that actually leaves me with a final thing, and I'm fully aware of NUT representation here. I think teacher unions have to be far more responsible about taking Ben Levin's imprecations seriously and actually start providing professional sites for their members which allow them the freedom and the capacity to actually share their learning and discuss what, in the widest sense, teachers' professional development is. Now, there are some unions that are doing that. There are some unions that have done that. There are some unions that could do it in future. But actually, all I'm saying is there is a living example of that happening already through the summit. Thank you. Right.